Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Prince of Sunset by Steve White, narrated by Sean Compton. Chapter 1. Niord, New Phoenicis 4, 3889 CE. Afterwards, Basil Castellan was always certain that it had all begun the day he'd been rescued by the dragon. Oh, it hadn't been a real dragon, of course. So he hastily assured everyone to whom he told the story. Only, it had been a real dragon. He would never share that particular knowledge with anyone but Sonia and Torval. His feet started to slip as he mounted the trail, such as it was, and he scrambled to compensate, grabbing at the slender trunk of a sapling. He felt a sense of kinship, for its species was a Terran import like his own, and the tree evidently agreed, for it held. He pulled himself upright and regained his footing, then resumed hiking uphill. The ridgeline couldn't be too much farther. Not that he could see it yet, for he'd walked upward into a low-lying cloud that enveloped this region of the Kraken Range, into an enchanted world of pearly mist, made subtly iridescent whenever the afternoon light of New Phoenicis came streaming through the occasional rift. Then, abruptly, he was above the clouds, and the ridgeline was just ahead. He hastened his steps and soon was at the summit, standing under a crystalline blue sky, in which Niord's small, intense white sun rode serenely with only a few fleecy high-altitude clouds for escorts. He stood breathing heavily, but only for a moment. He was a healthy young man of 15 years, local years, of course, 18 of the standard years of faraway Earth in which people's ages, as well as history, were generally measured. And exertion in this thin mountain air was more exhilarating than exhausting. He turned slowly in a circle, automatically shading his eyes against a slightly more ultraviolet-rich sunlight than they'd evolved under. Below and to the east, whence he'd come, the wooded mountainside sloped down into the clouds that rested against it like an ocean lapping against a breakwater. But elsewhere all was dazzling clarity, and he could see forever through air that had never known large-scale burning of hydrocarbons. Northward and southward the mountains curved away into infinity, while to the west a whole series of upland valleys spread themselves verdantly at his feet. Beyond them the further ranges of the Kraken rose, range piled upon enormous range. Dark forests clothed the lower slopes, but above the timberline the peaks rose through snow and glaciers to altitudes where no life could exist. After a while he dragged his eyes from those god-remote titans and gazed down at the valleys below, checkerboarded with fields and dotted with curious little towns, where a few pure-blooded old Niorders still spoke the language their ancestors had brought from a part of Earth called Scandinavia. The sun was warm, but his jumpsuit's molecularly engineered material responded to his sweat by breathing more copiously, and no discomfort distracted him from the view. He was still in familiar territory, for he'd come to this crag many times in the course of his youth, sometimes in the company of friends, but more and more often alone. Here, with what seemed like the entire continent on display far below, he'd always felt an irrational but nonetheless real sense of isolation. His problems were down there in those distant valleys and plains, and couldn't touch him. Which was why he'd come today, for what would probably be the last time. He'd already taken a long look through the window of his old room at a familiar panorama that had suddenly seemed strange, and disposed of certain objects which he'd somehow never quite gotten around to throwing out. But this seemed the right place to complete the relinquishment of boyhood. He shook his head, irritated with himself. It must, he decided, be the thinness of the air. His mother, a planetologist by profession, had explained it long ago. Niord is a relatively massive world compared to old Earth, she'd clipped in lecture mode. Is that what they mean by 1.13G? He'd piped up, eager to display his precociousness. How old had he been that day? Don't interrupt. And yes, that means that our gravity is stronger than Earth's standard. At the same time, our atmosphere is somewhat thinner. That's all right at sea level or even on this plateau, but the gravity causes the atmospheric density to drop off faster with altitude. You might say the atmosphere is shallower and harder. Anyway, that's why the higher peaks of the Krakens are lifeless. They're in near vacuum. She'd indicated the distant pale blue mountains to the west that seemed to float above the cityscape beyond their back garden. And it's why you and your friends have to be very careful hiking, even on the established trails. As you climb higher, the air can get dangerously thin before you know it. He'd stopped listening, for his eyes had followed her finger toward the mountains and stayed there. Is it true, he'd asked softly, that a Luan lives up there? Well, she'd replied, slightly ill at ease, there are always stories. Nobody knows how many Luan Li are left on this world, if any. Certainly not more than a very few. Some people claim to have seen one in this part of the Krakens, but they were probably just imagining things. Luan Li are hardly ever seen unless they want to be seen. Why? I mean, if they're so big... Her unease had deepened. It has to do with telepathy. All his resolve to seem grown up and sophisticated had fled, leaving him alone with the childhood fears that were part of his culture's legacy. You mean they can control your mind? Don't be silly. The theory is that they can, implant certain suggestions, including the negative one that you haven't seen something. She'd taken a deep breath and turned severe. Don't bother your head with such things. Even if there are any Luan Li left on Niord, they keep to themselves, just as they do on all the worlds where they live. But, he'd protested, if nobody ever sees one, how do we know they even exist? My friend Ivar says they don't. But Ivar hadn't said so very loudly. Oh, they exist, she had said, smiling and nodding slowly. If they didn't, we wouldn't be living here. Later, he'd learned what she had meant, and whenever he'd walked this trail, he had strained his eyes against the intense sunlight, hoping for just a glimpse in the royal blue sky. But none had been granted him, and it seemed none was going to be today. He stretched and rubbed a finger across the sun-browned skin of the back of his left hand. The imprinted circuitry glowed to life and showed him the time. He really shouldn't go any farther, not if he wanted to return the way he'd come. But he could always summon the air car he'd parked down below. It was quite capable of flying itself and seeking out his wrist communicator's homing beacon. Normally, neither he nor any of his friends would be caught dead, taking advantage of any such unworthy expedient. But now, on the eve of his departure for Sigma Draconis, he was above all that. Wasn't he? He sighed. Maybe he should start back now. He began to turn, then paused for a last look at the vista, which, like so much else, he was leaving behind. It was then that a metallic-seeming glint of reflected sunlight in the high, deep blue vault of heaven caught his eye. It didn't register at first. Surely it must be a high-altitude aircraft, although few such flew above this region. But no, the glint wasn't really metallic, for it was not quite coppery and not precisely golden, and as he focused on it, he could make out the impossibly slow beat of vast wings. A Luan, he breathed, fearful to shatter the crystalline fragility of the moment. Then, as he watched, the Luan caught an updraft and snapped its wings out to full extension, swooping into a southward glide, and was gone from sight. The lateness of the hour was forgotten. He had to get another look. He looked to his left. The trail led upward as it followed the ridgeline to the south. Perhaps the Luan was headed to its home among the higher crags. Nobody really knew where they lived, but it was well known that they liked mountains, and his imagination conjured up a titanic eyrie where the Luan perched, or whatever, in lonely majesty. Without hesitation, he started upward. It was steep, and the trail seemed little used. He paused to pick up a fallen limb that was the right length to make a walking stick. He made good time with its aid, leveraging himself up the increasingly steep trail and dismissing his occasional, annoying dizziness with a headshake and a deep breath. In his eagerness, he didn't notice that he was having to do so more and more frequently. The woods were thinning, leaving the view obstructed only by a few stunted trees. Soon, surely, he must catch another sight of the Luan. The thought made him glance upward, and he momentarily lost his footing. He muttered a word that even now would have drawn a rebuke from his mother, irritated by the way his head spun as he steadied himself. Then, up ahead, he saw that the trail narrowed as it skirted the right-hand side of a crag. To the right of the trail, a sheer cliff fell away. There'd be a matchless view from there, he thought, as he resumed his heavy breathing progress. The trail was rough as well as narrow as it wound around the crag. Fortunately, he'd never been afflicted by a fear of heights, and the view was even more spectacular than he'd expected. He rested his back and looked around for a sight of the Luan. There was no flash of reflected sunlight anywhere in the sky, but maybe the Luan had left some trace of its habitation nearby. He leaned forward, using the stick to support his weight, and peered southward. With a sharp crack, the stick snapped. His oxygen-deprived brain responded with nightmarish slowness as he began to topple forward. He tried to throw himself back and regain his balance, but then his feet began to slip, and in a timeless instant of terror, he was over the edge, scraping his back against the lip of the cliff as he fell. He flailed his arms wildly, seeking something to grab. As he did, his left wrist smashed into the cliff face, and he felt the stinging pain. Then he was in free fall, but only for a sickening moment. With an ankle-wrenching impact, he landed on a ledge. Then he began to slide off it, but this time his windmilling arms caught the stunted trunk of one of the dwarf trees, not of earthly origin, that grew through cracks in the rock at these altitudes. For a time, he simply hung there, feet dangling above the abyss, breathing in great gasps. Then, slowly and painfully, he pulled himself back up onto the little ledge. Only then did he yield to the shakes. At last he could think clearly, if somewhat sluggishly. All right, no problem. Call the air car. He brought his left hand up to speak into the wrist communicator, and then he remembered the pain in his wrist. The communicator's plastic casing should have held. He must have hit it against the rocks in exactly the right way, or rather, in exactly the wrong way. For a while, he just looked at the shattered device, ignoring the cuts made by jagged little fragments. They were the least of his worries. Finally, for lack of anything better to do, he tried to activate the communicator. The result was precisely what he'd expected. A brief crackling sound and a flicker of dying molecular circuitry seen through the breaks in the casing, then nothing. After a while, he became aware that the sun was almost touching the peaks to the west as Niord's 19.3-hour day drew to a close. His jumpsuit would compensate for external temperature changes up to a point, but in this thin air, the nighttime drop in temperature was extreme, and a slight chill was already invading him. He looked up and saw that the trail from which he had fallen wasn't too far above his ledge. Given anything at all to get a handhold on, he would have tried to climb the cliff wall, but there was only sheer stone. He tried to think constructively, if only to avoid leaving a vacuum for despair to fill. But all that came was resentment of the Luan for having lured him into this. He rejected it angrily as the irrational petulance he knew it to be, but it wouldn't go away. He couldn't get it out of his head. And as he thought about it, something else came to his mind, something he had never felt before, something that seemed to swell like an expanding sun until for a moment its glare filled his consciousness, filled the universe. Then he was warily approaching the edge of the rock outcropping on all fours. Odd, he'd never been afraid of heights before. He looked down the sheer cliff at the wooded valley below, and all at once he forgot to breathe. He'd gotten only the briefest, most distant glimpse of the Luan before. Now, in all its immeasurable splendor, it swept along almost skimming the tops of those trees so far below. Then, in a maneuver that its 30-meter wings couldn't account for, it banked and flung itself upward, all that mass arrowing straight up toward him at a velocity that must surely carry it past and on up into the darkening sky. Then it was level with him, and thrust its wings outward in a violent breaking motion that brought it to a sudden stop with a thunderclap sound that flung him physically back from the edge, stunned. He scarcely noticed, for he was face to face with a visage conjured up from myth, gazing into enormous amber eyes in whose depths he saw the source of that which had seemed to burn its way into his mind. The cold wind brought him back to consciousness. Then his situation began to register, one impossible impression at a time. The sun was setting and he was above the corrugated landscape of the eastern Krakens, headed south. He would surely have yielded to hypothermia had it not been for the warmth emanating from the great flying body against which he was being held. What was holding him was one of the four specialized arms between the wings and the head. Aft of the wings, he knew, would be four more limbs, the legs and two that could function as either legs or arms. All those limbs, including the two that specialized as wings, were arranged in pairs. The Luan Li might not be vertebrates. Evolution had produced something far more flexible than a spinal column on their unknown homeworld, but they were bilaterally symmetrical. Just ahead of him was the great head that a native of Earth might have characterized as vaguely crocodilian in a lighter-jawed sort of way until he saw the eyes. One of those eyes, their settings were wonderfully flexible, turned to gaze at him. Ah, you are conscious. A sensation of relief accompanied the bell-clear words into his mind, but then came concern at the cultural phobias that had come roaring to the surface of his consciousness. Please, set your mind at rest. I am, it is true, communicating with you telepathically, but your innate resistance to such communication is such that I can only detect consciously organized surface thoughts, such as those that a non-telepath such as yourself formulates in the process of speech. A certain sensitivity to emotions is an unavoidable concomitant. But with that exception, your mental privacy is as secure as it is when you are conversing with a fellow human. Basil knew about his own psi resistance, for like everyone else, he'd been tested for such talents at an early age. Of course, there was no knowing how effective it would be against an alien's powers, but somehow it never occurred to Basil to doubt the Luan's words, or to suspect that his lack of doubt was a result of mental manipulation. He could only ask, "Where are you taking me?" in a voice that the wind whipped instantly away into inaudibility, but which the Luan heard perfectly. "Since night is falling, I thought it best to take you to shelter before the temperatures fell to a level that is dangerous to you. In the morning, I will convey you to the nearest human habitation, unless you have a specific destination in mind." "My air car," he muttered. For a fact, the wind was biting into him cruelly, and his eyeballs were starting to ache. But he felt oddly detached from all such sensations, as detached as he was from fear. The stars were coming out, and one of the moons was rising as they approached a cliff. For a moment of panic, Basil thought the Luan was going to crash into it. But then the great wings went into braking configuration, and the Luan lost velocity with an abruptness that almost stunned its human passenger. Very slowly, they continued to approach that rock wall. "Prepare yourself," said the calm, asexual pseudo-voice in his head. The moonlit sky around them and the world beneath them vanished. Basil had no opportunity to lose his sanity, for without the passage of any time at all, they were in an interior that seemed too vast to be indoors, landing with a bone-rattling thump, and the Luan was using its legs and dual-purpose limbs to come to a running stop. Conservation of momentum, he thought, with a brain that only wanted to gibber. The irresistibly strong arms released him and he sank to the stony floor, content for the moment to let the sudden warmth soak into his bones. Presently, his surroundings began to register. He could see clearly, although the artificial lighting's source was obscure. but it was difficult to make out the vaulted ceiling and soaring walls, for his initial impression of immense space had not been exaggerated. His intellect insisted that spaces designed to accommodate Luan Li must be vast as a matter of simple practicality. The rest of him knew he stood in the hall of the Mountain King. The chamber was carved out of solid rock, and he had not the slightest doubt that it was inside the mountain they'd been approaching. It must fill most of it, and he wondered how and when the Luan Li had scooped out a mountain's insides. The thought made him turn and look at his rescuer. The Luan had its legs drawn up under it and its other limbs extended to prop it into a sitting position, and it gazed from a height of only about half its total length, slightly more than 3 times Basil's height. Its wings were folded, although there was plenty of room to flap them in this titanic hall. The odd illumination, indefinably different in quality from electric light, shimmered on the fine scale pattern of its hide. "So you can teleport, too," Basil heard himself say. Something about the acoustics made his voice seem less tinny than it should have in this hollow mountain. The Luan didn't physically nod its head, but a sensation of nonverbal affirmation touched Basil's mind as the soundless words came in their unhurried way. "The technique is inherently limited, but it has its uses." Concern. "Are you hungry? Our species' dietary requirements are not identical, but there is a considerable overlap, so I can offer you sustenance."
"I have my own food." Basil indicated his pouch and canteen. He wasn't hungry, but he found he was suffering from a bad case of dry mouth. He took a swig of water from the canteen, wishing he'd brought something stronger.
"Thank you for saving me," he continued belatedly.
"Why did you do it?"
Puzzlement. "You were obviously in distress and would hardly have survived the night. I followed an elementary ethical imperative. And besides..." For the first time, there was a perceptible hesitation in the Luan's telepathic cadence. "I knew your great-grandfather, Boris Markzali." Basil's lulled apprehensions awakened.
"What? But you said you could only read the thoughts I actually vocalized, and I haven't told you who I am."
"Compose yourself. I know you as the son of Arabella Markzali Castellan and the late Lysander Castellan, because I know of your mother, a noted student of my species. Which reminds me, a moment ago you observed that we could teleport too. May I ask what you meant by that particular phraseology?"
"Well," Basil began, not noticing that the subject had been deftly changed. "The first humans to encounter you were unable to account for your ability to fly. It was a manifest impossibility for beings as massive as yourselves."
"Approximately 3/4 of a metric ton in your terms," the Luan interjected.
"It was clear that you must be able to somehow neutralize or shield against gravity. At first it was theorized that you had some kind of contragrav generator, not that anyone had any notion how to build one then, surgically implanted in your bodies."
Basil wondered fleetingly if the Luan could sense his distaste and embarrassment.
"That was back when people used to do that sort of thing a lot, you see. So the idea naturally occurred to them. But it didn't make sense. You wouldn't have evolved in the wild as flyers if you couldn't fly without advanced technology. So after Antonescu established the scientific basis of psi phenomena, it was suggested that maybe you used psionic levitation for lift, and that the wings were for lateral movement only. My mother has always favored that theory, even though it doesn't seem to make evolutionary sense either." He trailed an abashed halt as the Luan's amusement communicated itself nonverbally to him.
"I see that you have come to share your mother's interest in us, and also, perhaps, the characteristic academic tendency to lecture."
The Luan paused, whether thoughtfully or for effect, Basil couldn't tell.
"In point of fact, she is correct."
Basil grew aware that his mouth was hanging open. In the 16, or was it 17, standard centuries since human interstellar explorers had first set unbelieving eyes on a Luan, The aliens had never evinced the slightest hostility toward humankind, but neither had they volunteered any solutions to the mysteries implicit in their existence. They had simply remained aloof, living out their unimaginably long lives in solitary splendor. Never had two of them been seen together, amid the mountainous terrain they seemed to prefer. Only rarely did they deign to notice their small, ephemeral supplanters. But, the Luan broke into his thoughts, why do you say this violates evolutionary logic? Basil ordered himself not to stammer. He didn't know why he was being singled out to receive such knowledge, but he had to prolong this unique moment as long as possible. This flow of revelations must be made to continue.
Well, a species' evolutionary history occurs before it becomes sentient, but that is, before psionic powers become possible. It's like the notion of the implanted contragrav device. Evolution wouldn't have prepared you to exercise a capability you weren't going to acquire until later.
Your logic is faultless, but your premises are not. You see, our evolutionary ancestors acquired an elementary form of psionic levitation while still pre-sentient. Basil's mouth started to open, but in his mind he felt the equivalent of an upraised, forestalling hand. Yes, I know. Psionic phenomena are a concomitant of neural activity above a level of complexity which is normally associated with sentience. But our brain structure, like our physiology, is the unique product of an equally unique series of evolutionary accidents. What I believe you would call an evolutionary hothouse plant. We became aware of this when we left our homeworld.
I suppose, Basil began hesitantly, hardly daring to ask for more information than he'd already been given. That's why you engaged in so many terraforming projects.
Leaving aside your ethnocentric terminology, the answer is yes. Renewed amusement. I perceive that this accounts for the interest your mother, a planetologist, not an exobiologist, has shown in us.
Yes, planetology is an offshoot of astronomy, and astronomers used to be conditioned to think in terms of a lifeless universe. But then we started to learn something about the planetary systems near Sol, and that stopped being possible.
Epsilon Eridani had been the first. That K2V star, only 11 light-years distant, had once seemed one of humanity's most promising neighbors. Less massive than Sol, and burning with a relatively cool orange glow, it nevertheless belonged to that narrow range of main-sequence stars that could conceive and nurture a world at an orbital distance where liquid water was possible, neither tide-locking such a world into dual helds of searing and frozen hemispheres, nor consuming it prematurely within the fiery envelope of an expanding red giant. Even before the first landing on Earth's moon, electronic ears had been cocked in Epsilon Eridani's direction, hoping to hear the voices of other radio users. Then, in the last decade of the 20th century, the realization had sunk home. Epsilon Eridani was rotating at the undignified rate of a young star. It hadn't existed long enough to slow to the more sedate spin of stellar adulthood. Any planets it possessed would be barren at best, molten at worst. The quest for life had turned elsewhere. Only in a spirit of curiosity about earlier stages of planetary system formation, and as a matter of distinctly low priority, had the 21st century's space-based instruments been turned toward Epsilon Eridani. They had found the spectral lines that meant free oxygen, and therefore life. Somebody, it seemed, had been up to something. The astronomers never recovered, according to Mother. Some of them simply denied the findings until the first interstellar probes confirmed them. By then, other living worlds that shouldn't have existed had come to light, including this one. When the first colony ships reached those worlds, they found various species that were identical or nearly so on all of them. And on some of them, us. For a time there was silence inside Basil's skull, beneath which he thought to detect a brooding undercurrent. Then the Luan resumed, at first with seeming irrelevance.
Our development differed from yours. For example, since we knew psionic phenomena to be possible, we were able to attain an understanding of them at an earlier stage.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?